This is AgriPulse Open Mic. I'm your host, Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is House Ag Committee member and Florida Republican, Kat Kamak. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. AgriPulse Open Mic continues with Congresswoman Kat Kamak next.
Today's Open Mic segment is brought to you by America's crop insurance industry, which is thankful for the continued support of farmers, commodity organizations, rural businesses, lenders, and lawmakers who are fighting to maintain a strong farm safety net, providing individualized protection on more than 490 million acres of farmland. Crop insurance remains the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply.
This is AgriPulse Open Mic. Republicans in the House of Representatives have spent the last few weeks searching for a new leader and a path for that leader to gain the necessary support in a chamber floor vote. Florida Republican Kat Kamak says aside from searching for the right candidate, the party might need to search for the right governing mindset as well.
I think that there are people who never left the campaign trail. Much of the same rhetoric that they used is easy on a campaign trail. It's the bomb throwing. It's the, you know, easy to digest sound bites. But governing is difficult. And with 218, you can do anything. But with such slim majorities, it's hard for people to get to that point. And so I think we have a lot of rebuilding of trust collectively as a conference that we need to do. But we also need to keep in mind that in this particular moment, we're up against a clock. We have tremendous implications that come with a shutdown. Many people think that the government shuts down and all the spending stops. Actually, it goes up in a government shutdown, which is one of the wild elements of government. And then, of course, you have a lot of the backroom deals that so many people are just sick and tired of. I know for me, I am very sick and tired of the, oh, we had a deal, or you promised me this, and it cuts so many ways across the conference that at this point in time, I think that there needs to be a healthy dose of transparency here in the Republican conference of things that people have asked for, things that people have requested of leadership. Put your money where your mouth is. If you want to be a chairman, put it out for the American public to see. If you want a hideaway Capitol office, put it out for the American people to see. Because at the end of the day, we're here to serve the American people. And the keeping of secrets is no longer, and never has been in my book, acceptable. So I think before I can even get behind a candidate, we need to see some fundamental changes to the way that business is conducted up here in Washington. Because the institution, it's fractured.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the House Freedom Caucus. It's a group that you are personally not a member of as a member of Congress, but you've got some experience working with that group mm-hmm. as a staffer for a member who was the person who used to represent this very district, Ted Yoho.
Yeah.
So it's not as if you're a complete rookie when it comes to the internal dynamics of the of the House Freedom Caucus. And this is a group that has a lot of requests and a lot of thoughts when it comes to policy,
yes.
not the least of which relate to agriculture.
Yes.
That all being said, what would be your counsel, should the Republican leadership ask for it, on that Venn diagram between respecting the opinions and the views of the Freedom Caucus, but not allowing those opinions and views to have perhaps a bigger role in the operation of the House of Representatives than the membership size of the caucus might dictate?
Well, and I would even expand it beyond that. You know, I think it's bigger than just the Freedom Caucus. You have so many factions. Essentially, we're operating within coalition government. There's so many different, they call us the five families. I would venture to say there's more factions than just five, including a group of free agents, of which I consider myself to be one. It's important that leadership, particularly with these numbers, and not just even in this particular Congress where we have such a slim majority, but in all Congresses, they respect every member and their opinion, because at any moment, particularly in these times where social media is so dominant, you can have a member who will say and do something completely extravagant and wild, and do it for clicks and views and shares and, you know, small dollar donation fundraising. I call it the angertainment model that many of my colleagues have adopted. But I would say, having experience with the Freedom Caucus, part of the challenge is that being a member of the Freedom Caucus means that you have to turn your vote card over to the group. You have a requirement as a member of Freedom Caucus to not only pay thousands of dollars to join the organization, but then you have to vote with them 80% of the time. My constituents back home in Florida's third, they own my voting card. No group, no other member, no specialty interest group has my voting card. Only my constituents control my voting card. And so that's in large part one of the reasons why I am not a member, but I am considered Freedom Caucus adjacent. And to that end, many of my friends are members. And as I talk to them on ag issues, I continually come back to, historically, the Freedom Caucus has voted in a large block against the farm bill. And of course, we can all talk about the nutritional side of where the lion's share of spending goes towards. In this case, the farm bill that we're working through is 82% nutritional. And you just take a step back from that, the amount of money that's going into the actual food production and the people who are putting the food on the shelf versus the people who are taking the food off the shelf, it is just fundamentally unbalanced. And for so many producers around the country, it's becoming an untenable situation. So I ask my Freedom Caucus friends to think of the farm bill as a national defense strategy, because a nation that cannot feed itself is not secure. And so rather than trying to attack food production and farm programs that are the very basic safety nets, the very basic elements that allow people who have so much skin in the game and so much risk out in the fields, I ask them to think of it in those terms rather than how it has been framed over the years, and I would say even decades at this point, of, you know, corporate subsidies. So I think that that's an element of the discussion that we need to be talking about when we're talking about my conservative friends. Because I have a lot of conservative friends that are supporting the farm bill, but particularly when it comes to House Freedom Caucus, they have stood in opposition to it.
Well, and let's talk about that farm bill and go a little deeper in that conversation. Yeah. Because with a new piece of legislation expected, you know, at some point in the future, with the 18 bill now, quote unquote, expired at the end of September, mm-hmm. I do wonder, does the Republican leadership have the chance to try to move a bipartisan bill, given the thin margins of, you know, within the Republican Party, given the demands that some folks have made in relation to farm policy? Does a bipartisan bill stand a chance on the House floor, or does the leadership at the same time have the ability to pursue, given those thin margins, some kind of GOP-only kind of package?
I don't think that a GOP-only package would be possible in the current dynamics that we're experiencing here on the House floor. Because for some members, you have Republicans in Biden plus 13 districts, meaning it is overwhelmingly a Biden-supporting district. And for them, they are not going to support the cuts and reforms that we have made to the nutritional programs, for example. And then on the other side of that, you have members who offered through the AgApprobes process amendments to strip any kind of support for, and I'm just pulling one out of the air, the sugar program, for example. They claim that that's, you know, a subsidy. And again, I go back to most of the time people are operating off of talking points from 15 years ago. And you start educating them about farm policy and then they start to come around. But when you're in margins where you maybe have three or four votes to play with and you have such extremes on both ends of your own party, it's really, really a difficult, narrow path that we have to be able to navigate down. And so I think that this will be a bipartisan farm bill. I think the more that we have to give up in terms of bringing Democrats along, it really is a disservice to the farm production side of and conservation side of the bill. So I am very mindful of that as we go through the drafting process and then subsequent amendment process. And one of my strategies throughout this year has been to really work with my colleagues from the Freedom Caucus side of the party to get their ideas in base text so that they feel like they have skin in the game going in, where rather than, you know, voting against it on the floor, they have an opportunity to say, you know, I crafted and modified and did things that are meaningful, conservative and productive and good for food production. I think that's the way we have to go about it, rather than trying to do this at the very end. Try to get people in on the front end.
Mm-hmm. So given the increased spending through the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program that is mandatory spending in the bill, given the requests for increased safety nets, increased reference prices that many producer groups are supporting, and also given the very tight budget environment that is existing on Capitol Hill right now,
yes.
How do you all go about pursuing a bill that does what it needs to do, but also maintains fiscal responsibility and is mindful of the growing federal deficit?
Well, personally, I'd love for us to go after the waste, fraud, and abuse in the nutritional programs. That could help us with some offsets needed to give a little bit of breathing room to our producers who have been dealing with increased input costs, whether it's fertilizer, fuel, or, of course, labor. And, you know, in my home state of Florida, we have an adverse wage effect that has really put a real squeeze on our folks, particularly, those that are utilizing H-2A labor. So I think that that would be a way to do some offsets. And I wholeheartedly agree, given all of the considerations of increased input costs along with supply chain issues and the regulatory environment that has continued to squeeze producers every which way, I would love to see an increase in reference price. That being said, I have several producers and different commodities that they need to see a base update of some sort. I would like to advocate for a voluntary base update with certain commodities, because I recognize that a base update across the board would blow the caps, and we just don't have the money for that. So I think that there's a bit of a balancing act that we have to strike when it comes to a reference price increase along with a base update to give that opportunity for people who maybe don't have base acres to be able to compete. And so we're working through some of the finer points of that, and I know that's super in the weeds, but that's what I think is necessary, certainly in this farm bill.
Let's stay in the weeds for a second then and keep talking about the base update, because there's obviously a lot of folks that have looked at that conversation from a Midwest versus a Southern versus a Western perspective. For Northern Florida,
yes.
Walk me through what a base update means and what particular commodities are we talking about here that stand to perhaps gain or maybe lose some base acres.
I use the term voluntary deliberately because I believe under a voluntary base update that has the potential to be a win-win situation for a lot of different commodities and producers. If you do a mandatory, I think that's when you start seeing caps blown out. That's where you start seeing winners and losers. And we don't want to do that. I think that there is a bit of a symbiotic relationship between the reference price increase and a base update, a voluntary base update. In my case, for example, we have peanuts in my part of the world, where to the north and to the west, you have most of the peanuts being grown on base acres. For my young farmers coming up, they don't have the same level playing field. They're coming at this from a disadvantage, and they have to plant thousands and thousands more acres just to even compete on the scale of those that have base. And so I even go so far as to say that this campaign to engage in a voluntary base update, even scheduling out the commodities, because we certainly don't want this to turn into a turf war situation between the Midwest producers and the Southeast. That's not it at all. I think that this entire campaign and move to do this really is about the young farmers. We talk at length about how are we going to get the next generation involved. And anyone who is even close to agriculture knows that this next generation of farming families has at least one real estate agent that is out there selling off pieces of the family farm. That's true in Florida. That's true in Texas. That's true all across the country. And it's because you have to be at such a scale and it's so capital intensive that it's virtually impossible to make a living in agriculture today unless you were born into it. So for me, this is about supporting that next generation, giving them a fighting chance, And really doing what we should have been doing all along is a regular schedule of updating the base acreage. I think peanuts, cotton, rice would be a great start. I think because of the budgetary constraints that we're operating within, it makes sense to scale, to schedule and scale this. You know, I love my corn and soybean guys, but man, they would blow the caps by just blinking at a base update. And so I think that that's something that we can play with and really look to do a schedule that would have a long-term look at this. But if we don't do that, I think that even a reference price increase has no impact on the producers in my neck of the woods. And being the lone Republican who represents all of Florida agriculture in the House of Representatives, this is something that's critically important to my producers who are diversified, who don't have base, who are looking to really establish themselves as that next generation. So I think that there's a path forward. It's just going to be a little bit in the weeds, and we have a lot of educating to do along the way.
As we come into the home stretch of our conversation, let's shift things over to broadband, in particular the idea and the concept of rural broadband. As you talk to your constituents in, you know, maybe some more rural parts of your district, do they have the connectivity they need?
I don't think anyone has the connectivity they need if you're in rural America today. I mean, my goodness. It's wild to me that we have invested $42 billion and over 136 programs dedicated to addressing the broadband issue in America, and Congress and government just can't seem to get out of their own way. You have overbuilding in certain areas and then none in others. One of the things that has been particularly frustrating is the regulatory environment, where you have USDA and FCC all competing with each other, talking over each other, state maps competing with federal maps, private companies who are keeping their proprietary infrastructure to themselves, which I understand. But at some point, we all have to pull out a map and say, okay, where are we built out and where are we not? And I think some of the solutions have been, while well-intentioned, they have missed the mark in many ways. RDOF auctions, for example, is a great example of a lot of money spent and not a lot of action. And with a time frame of 10 years to produce a viable connection, well, that's just horse shit, in my opinion. I don't know if I can say that word on this, but that's how I talk. So it's been 20 minutes and I haven't said a curse word, so that's progress for me. It's wild to me that in 2023, we do not have every single American connected to high-speed, reliable, and affordable internet. I think what the co-ops have been doing here as of late is really the path forward, where you have in the 1920s and 30s, the electrification of America. That is really the moment that we're looking for with broadband, and I think it's going to be our local co-ops that do that in rural America. They have a connection to every home and every business. They can deliver better, faster, and cheaper than some of our bigger competitors and providers. And for areas where that's not a viable option, particularly as we're talking about high-tech ag and precision agriculture, we can be relying on low-orbit satellite connectivity like Starlink. I think that in conjunction with a wireless option, in addition to the dark fiber, that is really the trifecta of how we can make this work. And I'll use Central Florida Co-op in my own district as an example. They're offering services of 100 gigs up and down for $60 a month. And they're connecting 250, 300 homes a week. And they have figured out a way to do it without federal assistance. That, I think, is the path forward, which really is a shame because taxpayers have now been put on the hook for so many billions of dollars, but it tends to get lost in all the red tape.
You're a member of the Agriculture Committee, which has jurisdiction over USDA, which has been operating the ReConnect program. Mm-hmm. You're also on Energy and Commerce, with jurisdiction over the FCC and jurisdiction over the rural broadband efforts there. I think you might be able to see where I'm going with this, but if I can ask you to say something that might frustrate one or the other groups of your colleagues, what is the proper venue in your mind for rural broadband oversight?
Man,
agriculture or E&C?
You're really stirring the pot. You know, I would say one of the things, with all due respect to USDA, I think that the Energy and Commerce Committee absolutely has the jurisdiction and the means and resources by which to do this effectively, particularly with the FCC. The FCC has done a great job in employing a crowdsourcing of maps, which I think are really important. And, you know, when the USDA is falling down on their primary responsibility of supporting agriculture in America, to give additional aspects for them to oversee, I think is not necessarily the smartest strategy. So I know that that frustrates some of my ag colleagues, because certainly we all know, love, and come from rural America. But when it comes to getting this technology where it needs to be, I think that the FCC is probably the best avenue to do that.
Well, Congresswoman, we've covered a lot of turf in this conversation, a lot of area yet to be uncovered as well. We'll save that for a talk down the road. But as is tradition on this program, it is an open mic, and you have the last word.
Oh, well, I just want to say thank you, and to everybody listening. I mean, certainly to all of our farmers, ranchers, producers around the country, thank you so much for everything that you're doing to keep us fueled, clothed, and fed. But there's two elements that we didn't touch on that I want to make sure that we talk about. You know, even though we're waiting on this farm bill to come to light, one of the key things that we've worked very hard to embed into the text is a piece of legislation called the FFA Act. Now, that's obviously my hat tip to the Future Farmers of America group that I greatly support. I was a 4-H'er. I wasn't an FFA'er, but I still support my fellow FFA'ers. And what the bill does is it ties nutritional programs to our domestic production. Today, there is no requirement in, let's just use this year, for example, the $124 billion that we will spend in nutritional programs this year, only $26 million is required to be domestically produced. I'll repeat that, because to me, I think that's a staggering figure. Of $124 billion that the American taxpayers will spend on food stamps this year, only $26 million is required by law to be domestically produced. I think if it is an American taxpayer that is paying for it, it should be an American farmer that produces it. And so I want to use this opportunity and this platform to really drive home the message that we need to tie the two together, and that's a good way to give a lifeline to our producers. And then on top of that, in bringing down the costs, the input costs that we're facing in rural America, we have added, we've introduced legislation that would add potash and phosphate to the critical minerals list, which in some strange world, those two are not on the critical minerals list, which I'm shocked by. But it's that common sense type of legislation that I think will help, because when an element is added to the critical minerals list, there are certain provisions that streamline the permitting and the regulatory environment surrounding the mining of those minerals. And so I think that'll help drive down the cost, which is so key in getting a good quality product.
Our thanks to Congresswoman Kat Kamak, our guest this week on Open Mic. AgriPulse Open Mic is brought to you by NCIS, the National Crop Insurance Services. Crop insurance, the smartest, most efficient way to secure America's food, fiber, and fuel supply. For AgriPulse, I'm Spencer Chase.